On this edition of Retronauts, we don't need Ben Stiller for this night at the museum.
Just roll the music.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Retronauts. Thanks for joining us once again. My name is Ray Barnholtz, and with me today are Bob Mackey.
Hey, everybody.
On the line is Jeremy Parrish.
Uh-huh.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And from the podcast Watch Out for Fireballs, Gary Butterfield.
Hello, Ray.
Hello, Gary. So, yes, on this episode, we will be talking about retro compilations. And it's kind of an excuse for me to talk about something that I actually like to talk about, but it's also an excuse for us to get pretty grumpy because, Retronauts has been known for its complaining about things like Virtual Console and whatnot.
Right.
So I thought about just going ahead and exploring the history of such compilation products. And, it's been more than a while, actually, since even those compilations became retro themselves. And they've all had their ups and downs, like I said, as we've complained about. And some treated their history better than others, and it seemed like most of them were kind of just shoved into one pack as much as they could to try and make some money. But again, there's pros and cons to all that, and so I thought we would just go over the last 20 years of games within games, let's say. And I don't know, up front, I would say also this is also an excuse for me to talk about Namco Museum, which I quite enjoy, but
yeah.
We'll get to that. Up front, let's just say, you guys, anything that stood out to you as far as compilations in these past 20 years? Do you have a favorite? Is it something you like to come back to?
I can name a few, sure. But I'm sure we'll talk about them in greater detail soon. Super Mario All-Stars, definitely okay. One of the first ones that I really took notice of. And also the Mega Man and Mega Man X collections from maybe like a decade ago. I felt those were extremely robust.
Right.
And if you got them for the PS2, they were pretty accurate.
Actually, I think the Xbox ones were better.
Okay. I wasn't exposed to those, but I liked them on PS2.
Yeah. Well, we will certainly get into those. You know, you bring up Mario All-Stars, and that did not actually occur to me at first, just because it was a compilation of games from, like, you know, a few years prior.
Right, like maybe 5 years.
Yeah. And that's also one thing I want to get out of the way now, is that we're not really talking about single releases like Virtual Console, but actually things that were packaged as a sort of bundle deal. And it's like, oh, look, there's 50 games in one package. Check it out. So, yeah, I just want to get that out of the way first.
I personally categorize Super Mario All-Stars as something separate. You know, it's a remake, like an anthology remake. That's something you didn't really see before that, and you really don't see that much of now. It's kind of its own little weird creature.
That is true. So Gary, how about you? Anything stood out to you?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with these at all?
What am I doing here?
Are you more of a purist type? Are you the guy who likes to play on the, CRT TV?
Not at all. I mean, I do, but I also like to play, collections of games. I like that these came along, they bundled games that came out when it wasn't economically feasible for me to experience them all. So getting these kind of compilations allowed me to go back with some disposable income and kind of cut wide swaths of history.
Yeah.
You know, a part of one. I had the GameCube version of the Mega Man compilation, which had an unalterable B jumps, A shoots configuration. Yeah. So I did not think that was a good collection, but had the wrong system.
Now, Jeremy, you hummed in approval when I mentioned Namco Museum as well.
Yeah, I mean, not that it was necessarily the best, but it was really kind of the breakout star of this whole category of video games. And I don't know, there was something really nice about it. And I think that was around the time that the idea of going back to revisit older games really started to feel meaningful. Maybe we should talk about this later.
Sure.
But
sure.
Namco Museum definitely had a big impact. And I think also for me personally, the NES classics for Game Boy Advance.
Yeah.
I guess you could, that's not quite an anthology because they were individual releases, but it was a series of, you know, in Japan it was 30 games and definitely was meant to kind of go together, and there was a lot of love put into the packaging. And those just really, like, to me kind of cemented the fact that, hey, these games are worth revisiting and should be made available to play on contemporary systems because there's a lot of value in them.
Yeah. Well, then let's jump in. I guess we know what we're going to talk the most about later in the show. So I want to start with, you know, just go ahead into the chronology. And there's actually one example from way back in the 80s that I want to bring up. And that is a DOS collection called Golden Oldies. Now, this is from 1985. And you might think, well, what was retro in 1985? Well, not much, but in this particular collection called Golden Oldies, released by Electronic Arts, it had what was then classics, so like really primitive computer games such as Adventure, which was like really one of the first text adventures, an early simulation game called Life. I mean, it's just a bunch of really abstract colored patterns moving around, and it was sort of like Dwarf Fortresses now, actually, but that was one of them. And a artificial intelligence call and response program called Eliza that, you know, would respond to things that you told it and type to it. And then a port of Pong, but not that great because, you know, they were just trying to adapt an analog game to something that was really on a digital platform. But I found that interesting because, like, yeah, there were retro things even in the mid-80s. I mean, people recognize the fact that a lot of games started on those old mainframes, things where you had to be an employee of a university or something to actually get access to these things. So to see that sort of acknowledged in a way was interesting to me.
Yeah, so I have a question about Eliza. Was that actually presented as a video game? Because if we're talking about the same Eliza here, that was kind of an early attempt at sort of artificial intelligence text parser. Never really struck me as a game. It was more like an experiment to see if they could create convincingly conversational artificial intelligence. So that's I never realized that was actually released as a packaged product, and also that it was packaged with a bunch of video games. That's very strange.
Yeah, it is strange. I guess they were just trying to find examples of great computer programs that were entertaining, at least, not necessarily classified as games. But
as long as it was an oldie and it was golden, ended up in this compilation. Okay.
So what do you think the metric for judging goldenness was for them?
It's not like
you could actually buy Eliza. It's not like it was a bestseller.
Yeah.
That's very strange.
Like, yeah, it's not like they were from the 50s either. Yeah, good question. I guess they were just, I mean, Electronic Arts at the time was a sort of really, you know, stood by their name in that sense. They gave that Rockstar treatment to their developers. And I think in this case, they were just sort of curating great examples of programs from, you know, what was then the old days of computer entertainment. That's how I view it.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. I mean, this was EA around the time of games like Mule and other, like Jordan versus Bird. So all these games that were not only very seminal, but also that had the creators credited right there on the package. So
yeah,
that makes sense that it was kind of like, you know,
yep, absolutely,
almost like a rock musician going back and doing blues covers and saying, like, these are the songs that influenced me. Kind of the same thing with software and video games.
Yeah, I think that nails it for sure. So yeah, let's go ahead and jump ahead to like the early 90s, because that's what I'm familiar with, of course. And for whatever reason, like, retro compilations sort of became a thing on Windows for a few years in the 90s. I mean, there were Mac ports of things too, but Windows platform, as it grew in popularity, sort of got these different sorts of retro game compilations. And they were simple enough, I suppose. I mean, they were just sort of rudimentary games at the time. And they were more easily recognizable than, you know, the lesser known games that you might find in the Microsoft Entertainment Pack. I mean, they weren't Ski Free necessarily, although Ski Free is a classic now.
Right.
But like other collections or these value packs of games, they also tended to stay on the shelves a lot longer than most games, I would say, just because, you know, they have sort of an inherent value and brand recognition for people. So, one of the first ones was Microsoft Arcade in 1993. And this was just like a simple collection of Atari arcade games. There was Asteroids, Tempest, Battlezone, Centipede, and Missile Command. And like I said, these weren't complicated games to begin with, but it was impressive that they all fit on one floppy back then. So they must have had some pretty good magic going on there. So nothing really stands out in the quality of the ports or anything, but I did get it when I was a kid, and I did really appreciate the fact that the help files included in the game had these small history pieces about the games, and they explained the genesis of each one. So this is like where I found out about Dave Thurer's nightmares that inspired the creation of Tempest, for example, and the rumors about the military battle zone.
Hmm.
and things about that. I mean, I have no idea who wrote these actually, but I thought they were cool. And I think it really sort of one of the things, I guess, that jumpstarted my interest in video game history, oddly enough.
It was just, me.
Yeah. Yeah. So thanks, game. It's scary. Yeah. You're a child prodigy. So yeah, I would like sort of keep those help files around even after I deleted the actual Microsoft Arcade and, you know, just keep them around to read every once in a while. And that was pretty cool for me. So yes, that is really the only thing about that that stood out to me. But Microsoft did make other arcade packages. They made Return of Arcade and Revenge of Arcade, and those moved on from Atari games to Namco games. So we had like really heavy hitters like Pac-Man and Ms. Pac-Man and Xevious, well, heavy hitter in Japan maybe. Mm-hmm. And then you know, all those games that, you know, are now just everywhere, and they were later in Namco Museum. Those also just stuck around like Microsoft Arcade did.
There were a lot of adventure game kind of compilations around this time as well.
That's right.
I feel like
yes.
Yeah, so the LucasArts boxes, I think there were two editions of those.
I had both. That's how I got into
those. I thought those came a little later.
The second one definitely did. I think the first one was definitely kind of could still be considered early 90s.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah. Those stood out though because they were the packaging was odd. Mm-hmm. It was just like a
That was back when people actually put a lot of effort into boxes and you know, making something look appealing on the shelf.
Right, there was a window in the box. You can see all the discs. Was that how it was set up? Yeah,
yeah, and a cascading layout of the discs.
And it was they're being dug up like as if they were treasures or something. It was really neat.
Yeah,
that kind of meta
and it was secret advertising for the dig.
Oh no, coming soon.
Ah, yes.
That kind of meta presentation that comes later, where you're actually going through an arcade.
Yeah,
it's almost their version of that, where you're actually digging these things up, or you know, looking at them through a vault.
Yes, exactly. You know?
And LucasArts did have the triangular box for Day of the Tentacle, so they were sort of used to this.
That's right.
Playing with the packaging.
Yeah, another thing related to Microsoft Arcade and all that was that Ms. Pac-Man was the first Xbox Live arcade game on the original Xbox when they launched that whole thing.
Hmm.
So it all comes around. Yeah, congratulations to me for mentioning that.
Those old PC compilations of old video games, you know, kind of like you said, in the early to mid 90s. And at the time, I didn't really think too much of it. I was like, well, you know, why would I want to play a game like Tempest on a PC where it's not going to be the same experience at all? But I think a few years later, I started to appreciate classic games more. Maybe again, like we'll talk about this with Namco Museum, but because things started to change, like there was a material change in video games and how they looked and how they worked right around that time. And all of a sudden you started to realize, oh yeah, things are changing. And it made the things that had come before a little more precious. But I think when those compilations first arrived, I didn't quite have that sense yet. I was more like, I want to play Star Fox because triangles and space. Oh, it's so crazy.
Right, exactly. So
I wonder if part of it was kind of getting some games that were traditionally more of a console experience. So maybe if you were a PC gamer and, you know, spend most of your time in that period kind of playing, you know, text adventures or playing adventure games and having this, you know, even though it might be a little bit of a diminished experience because you're playing with a keyboard or one of those nightmarish gigantic flight stick joysticks, you know, it's just kind of dipping your toes into a kind of game that you're not used to.
Yeah.
Right, with like 12-year-old games. So you could say, man, console games are so primitive compared to the awesome PC games I'm playing. Like,
PC
this
Master
has
Race.
Nothing on Command and Conquer. Jeez, console games are so stupid and shallow.
LOL. Yes. But, you know, I think that sort of exists now as well because think about, like, iOS or Android, like, where you now Pac-Man is a free-to-play game with extra mazes that you can buy for it, but it's also all touch controls. And, like, it's okay touch controls, but, yeah, it is a different sort of experience than anybody ever had originally. So, yeah, I think that's an interesting thing to consider as well. So let's move on to another sort of franchise, and that was the Activision Atari 2600 Action Pack. And this is released a couple years later in like 95 or so. And this was for Windows 95. And it was basically every Activision Atari game worth remembering. So you had Pitfall, Kaboom, River Raid, you know, all the classics. That, all the ones that people Hero. Remembered. I didn't mean to sound too derogatory there. I'm just saying. If you had others, yes. Like that, when I say that those compilations stuck around, like this is the one I think of, because I would always go to Toys R Us and see it there on the PC shelf for years and years and years. And it was definitely one of those early examples of people just buying up games that they remembered very fondly. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it stuck around. There was also Action Pack 2. It was a good collection, but, you know, not as many more memorable Activision games, because, you know, they got it right the first time, basically. So, if you were extra obsessed with Activision games back then, perhaps you could find some nice obscure hits in there. And then, oddly enough, Action Pack 3 was all Atari-made games, although it was published by Activision still. It was weird, and I'm sort of kidding here, but this is like Activision starting to take credit for the 2600 Legacy.
Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah, they did that later with Activision Anthology, which we'll talk about, but that was, like, the packaging was done up as an Atari cartridge label, but they were so distinct from the Activision ones. I'm like, God, you guys, what's going on? So, I don't know. It's weird to me. But,
Can I have a sidebar about Mario All-Stars?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
I wasn't sure if we were going to skip it, but there's something I wanted to talk about.
Go ahead.
I had asked permission. You're running the show, Ray. But, did want to point out that it was the first time that we had gotten our hands on Mario 2, although we wouldn't have known that unless it was explained to us. But one thing I wanted to point out was, it had like the supreme, ultimate edition of Mario World in some editions. It was a bundle only. And it was a special Mario All-Stars that came with Mario World. And we're in the fiscal year of Luigi still, so this is relevant. Luigi had a unique sprite in Mario World, which was amazing. Uh-huh. Like, I played through the game as Luigi just to see the new sprite.
Yeah.
As pathetic as that sounds But,
you're right.
Like, when Nintendo released their 20th anniversary Mario Wii bundle, or Wii, what was it, a special edition or something like that?
Yeah. 20th anniversary Mario All-Stars.
Basically, the SNES ROM that they dragged into an ISO was not the Mario All-Stars and World. It was just Mario All-Stars, which always annoyed me. I mean, as much as they mistreated that release, they could have at least given us World 2.
That was, that was really unique. I think it was like only in America only.
Oh, really? Okay.
Maybe Europe too, or Australia somewhere got it as well. But yeah, that's...
It was so interesting though that they put more work into Mario World when they didn't have to. I just was like, was that the original plan for this game? And now it's like, now we have time to put the new Luigi sprite in or whatever. But I found that to be an interesting touch. And I think there are a few other small differences in the game too.
Yeah, a couple like that. That Luigi sprite. I remember, playing that on an emulator once. Like, what? I missed out on this?
Oh, but they also gave Luigi a sprite in Mario 3 as well. He had his own unique sprite in that game, too.
Did he?
For the All-Stars edition, he did. Oh. Yeah.
I don't remember that. I don't remember the Mario World one. But, then they made that standard with the Mario Advance series.
Right. And then
added maybe too much to those as well.
I always coveted that special edition of Super Mario All Stars plus Super Mario World, because, like you said, it was only bundled with systems, and you know, even on the secondary market, it's always been a lot more expensive than just Super Mario World or Super Mario All Stars, and that's one of those that I've never quite been able to justify buying, but sure would be great.
Outside of the Metal Gear Solid collection from recent years, I think that's one of the best collections of games to have ever been released.
Mm-hmm. So, that Activision pack, those were, 1995 up through 97 or so. And then 99 was that Revenge of Arcade from Microsoft that I mentioned. And then also at the same time, Sega got into this game by releasing Sega Smash Pack for Windows. And this was just a package of several fondly remembered Genesis games. You know, you had Altered Beast, Columns, Revenge of Shinobi, except Sonic. The only Sonic game was Spinball, and I don't think that's the best choice there.
So weird.
But also Sega released Sonic CD and then the Sonic & Knuckles collection for Windows, so maybe that they felt like, we'll just make them buy those instead.
So quick question for you, Ray. Are we doing this, like, by... platform grouping, like it was out for PC as opposed to chronologically?
No, I'm doing the chronology, basically, just trying to go through the 90s and then these really released then.
All right, well, I asked because, before the Smash Pack came along, Sega kind of dabbled in retro games a little bit with the Sega Ages for Saturn.
That's true, yes.
Was published. I didn't see that on your list, but Like, to me, that was kind of a remarkable release because, you know, they did the Sonic Jam thing, sure, whatever, but Sega Ages came out and had kind of a scattershot collection of games, and then Sega didn't publish it. Working Designs did, at least in the U.S.
Oh, I forgot about that. Wow.
Yeah, it was like this kind of really weird standalone thing that has a lot of strangeness about it, but at the same time, like, again, was kind of one of those first recognitions that, hey, our old video games are kind of cool, and we should, you know, treat them with respect.
Hmm.
At least on consoles.
Yeah. And Sega has done that the most, I think, out of, you know,
by
compared
far.
To even Namco. Yeah, for sure.
The first Smash Pack, what was impressive about it to me was a lot of these compilations focused on kind of arcade games or arcade experiences. And it had Phantasy Star 2 on it. And that was, you know, I was still kind of a JRPG nut. At the time when
you,
I first
got my
hands on
this. You don't remember the arcade version of Phantasy Star 2?
Yeah, I never had enough quarters to finish it. I just got to the first one, and I had a big piece of graph paper taped to the side to do those maps with the teleporter traps.
I imagine it had like a roll of graph paper, like toilet paper attached to the machine.
Yeah, double red stripe, or run out. Run out. Go change the graph paper down in Aladdin's Castle. But that was really impressive to me because I'd grown up watching my cousin play that game, but at the time I was doing that, I couldn't really comprehend it, but I was always kind of fascinated by it. So that was my first, you know, I wasn't a Sega kid. I didn't have a Genesis growing up. So I was really excited to be able to play that.
Yeah. I think that was the case for a lot of people as well. You got a chance to sample that game and it was a big full game as well. So that helped out a lot.
But, yeah. The thing about these PC compilations, in the '90s, and, you know, even kind of into today, is there always seemed to be this kind of, like, sketchiness about them. And it's nothing to do with the platform, but I think it's because I always got the impression that, like, these weren't, you know, official products. It's not like the companies who made the games originally worked on them. They were just kind of like a bunch of games thrown together with questionable emulation or programming quality. Like, I don't know. There was something that always just seemed kind of half-baked about them. Was I alone in feeling that way? Maybe I was burned by the Mega Man PC games by High Tech Expressions or whoever the heck did those.
Well, that's definitely a different case there.
Yeah.
I can understand, though.
There was a lot of, there's one company that got a lot of flack in the kind of beginning Xbox 360 era, something Bone Entertainment?
Backbone.
They got a lot of flack for their crappiness.
They used to be Digital Eclipse.
Right.
And they also were this company that kind of started doing those sorts of retro ports for Windows and other computer platforms. And then they sort of made it their core business as they ported other classic games to, you know, anything, any system you can name, basically. And then, once they merged and became Backbone, they sort of drove that into the next generation.
They also drove it into the ground.
Yeah. People did not really appreciate their emulation, and for good reason. A lot of sound problems, you know, they would implement online multiplayer, but it would always be broken somehow, and then, you know.
And I'm jumping way ahead of things, but were they part of Microsoft Game Room? Were they the sort of the driving force, or is that another company?
That was developed by Chrome.
Okay, got it. I confuse all these places.
Yeah, I know. Well,
we can talk about it later, but I think, you know, the difference between the Sega Ages that M2 put together in Japan versus the Sonic Sega Genesis collection and all that stuff that Backbone put together kind of drives home the difference in quality between the great and the not so great.
Yeah. So, I admit my organization of this is pretty spotty, but I just wanted to focus on chronology and then maybe series because I don't want to get too off track with certain things. So let's continue with Smash Pack because this is the first time I believe that a company officially licensed someone else's emulator. Mm. This is basically a dressed up version of Steve Snake's K-Gen emulator. Now he's made Kega Fusion, which is another great emulator for basically all the Sega consoles, essentially. And but this was back, you know, 99 when someone does this, at also like the height of the whole emulator scene when things started coming together and people started creating more console game emulators and arcade game emulators.
It was way better than Genesis.
Yeah, well.
More fun to say, or less troubling to say.
That is true.
Always. Yeah. But actually, Steve Snake had been in the game industry before, so I mean, he was a talented programmer. He knew what he was doing.
Oh wow!
So,
can you name anything that he worked on, or
just a smattering of different things?
Okay,
like you can look him up on Moby Games or something if you'd really like to. But he had been in the game industry for years, and so this, I don't think this was like reaching out to a nobody on the internet, some hacker or somebody. I mean, he knew what he was doing. So Sega licensed this emulator and redressed it as Sega Smash Pack and put a few games on it. And that's pretty cool, I think. And they released Smash Pack 2, I think, a year or so later. More of the same. I mean, no standout games necessarily, except they put in Sonic 2 this time, so there's that. But yeah, that was a good PC series. And like I said, Sega also released the Sonic & Knuckles collection, which was just simple Windows 95 ports of Sonic & Knuckles and Sonic 3. And then there was the Sonic & Garfield pack.
What?
Which was, what was it? I think it was Sonic & Knuckles. And then the Garfield Genesis game for Windows.
Wow.
And the box art.
Wow. That's... Wow, that's amazing.
It's a match made in heaven.
Those two titans.
Finally.
Yes.
They got my letters.
Yeah. And on the box art, they're standing side by side. And yes, very endearing.
God.
So that's Smash Pack on PC. But then, in 2001, they made a Dreamcast version. And this, there's nothing notable about this in the game selection. It's just the story behind it. Because this thing has so many weird facts about it. So Dreamcast Sega Smash Pack. First of all, I might as well talk about the game list. It's kind of a combination of both of the PC ones, except they also added Wrestle War, which, by the way, a game I forgot to mention on the wrestling episode, the Genesis game Wrestle War, tells you how memorable that is. But this was also only available in a new Dreamcast console bundle. So it was kind of like that Mario All-Stars, Mario All-World.
Oh, okay.
Mario World thing. You could only get it if you bought the specific Dreamcast bundle at the time. It was also released at the same time Sega announced they were going to stop producing the Dreamcasts. So.
Yeah, I was going to, like, what was the name of the bundle? The Help Us bundle? Yeah. The We Love You bundle? Yes.
It's a very humble bundle.
Yeah.
The Swan Song bundle. Yeah, this was January 2001. That was when that happened.
Wow.
This also included the only U.S. release of the Dreamcast port of Virtua Cop 2. Which was only a Japanese release otherwise,
oh, wow.
A separate Japanese release, so...
Did that support a light gun, or did they also hack that one so that you had to use the D-pad?
Oh, I don't know. It probably did, yeah. I mean...
Oh, because, yeah, Sega was really big on gimping its shooters during the Dreamcast era because of, you know, school shootings and stuff. So all the other light gun games that came to Dreamcast, I think, had the light gun support stripped out for the U.S.
Well, I think the big thing is that they didn't make their own gun. They didn't release it here. So it was up to, like, Mad Catz to release the only Dreamcast light gun in America.
They're like, our reputation is bad enough. We could be getting into this business.
So you got that extra bonus of Virtua Cop 2. Let's see, what else? Oh, the emulator sound is incredibly bad.
Mm.
Everything sounds way, way off. And, you know, Genesis sound is good when it's very accurate, and very bad when it's not very accurate. So, very, very clangy and pingy and,
Yeah, like farting robots.
Yeah, that's probably, yeah. That's really where that whole, stereotypical phrase comes from. Yeah, it's farting robots. Mm. So, I mean, hey, I respect real Genesis sound. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then also, the programmer of Sega Smash Pack on Dreamcast, Gary Lake, he surreptitiously put in a text file with instructions to the pirate group Echelon, who had released all the Dreamcast pirated games during this time.
Oh, man, was there really great ASCII art at the beginning of that file, like a skull?
No, I think he left that up to Echelon.
Oh, man. Okay.
Anyway, he told them on how to tweak the emulator, and then, like, a few days later, they... released a version of said Smash Pack that had a ROM loader, so you could include any ROMs you wanted to.
Okay,
and wow. It would work on the same emulator that Smash Pack was running on. And that sort of...
Isn't that right around the same time that Sony announced that it was going to start publishing gigabyte discs, which coincidentally, or perhaps not coincidentally, was also the media that Dreamcast used? It was like CD-ROMs that could store a gigabyte of data, so not quite a DVD, but more than just a CD-ROM.
I've never actually heard of that, the Sony one.
Oh,
I haven't either.
But yeah, there is the GD-ROM, but a lot of those pirated Dreamcast games had things taken out of them so they could fit on normal-sized CDs. So there's that as well. But yeah, I never heard of that Sony gigabyte disc. Or maybe I had, but forgot about it. So the funny thing about that also is that sort of jump-started the Dreamcast emulator sort of sub-scene.
Yeah.
Because after that, you saw a bunch of different homebrew emulators come out for Dreamcast and things like Nestor DC, for example, and very interesting in that sense. So, but
this is slightly related, but wasn't Bleem, like, wasn't the Dreamcast the only place where Bleem was released?
No, it was on PC.
Oh, okay.
But yes, they did release Bleemcast,
With like two playable games or something, right?
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
That was a, it was a dedicated emulator for just, yeah, two games. Metal Gear and, Gran Turismo 2.
That's what I thought.
But yeah. So yeah, that's Sega Smash Pack for Dreamcast. Like I said, it's more interesting just on all these crazy things that were surrounding it more than what the actual games were like. There was another Smash Pack released about a year later on GBA after Sega had gone third party. This just has Golden Axe, Echo the Dolphin, and Sonic Spinball again, huh. And I don't think those are really the ones everybody cries out for when they think of great Genesis games I like to see again. But these were not exactly emulations either. They were more adjusted for the Game Boy Advance resolution. Decent enough, I guess, if you really like either of those games. I'm not a fan, really, but odd choices. But there were other Sega collections on Game Boy that we can talk about later. Smash Pack. Another sort of thing that came out around 99 was Intellivision Lives. Just sort of like, they were playing catch up to the Activision collection, I think. This is for Windows and came with a few different Intellivision games that people remembered fondly, and I'm going to say those two words a lot, so don't worry about that. things like Astro Smash and what have you. I remember actually buying this at the first Classic Gaming Expo in Vegas in 99. I think that's where they sort of announced it or something. And so it was basically, it was an initiative, like, the original guys behind the Intellivision, the original designers, they sort of, somehow retained the rights and started a new company and just sort of released Intellivision Lives. And there were other, versions of this released, years later for consoles as well. So you could get, your fix of Intellivision however you wanted. And so that was that. Next up, you know, Jeremy did mention Sega Ages for Saturn and how that was sort of related to Sonic Jam. So let's talk about Sonic Jam. And this was released in 97 for the Saturn. Anybody play this at all?
I have briefly, yeah. And that...
Just a little bit,
that
yeah.
Weird 3D, it was just like a single level, or was it the level select? I forget how it worked, but it felt like the biggest tease ever.
Yes, this was... Yep. This was Sonic Team's excuse for not making a real Sonic Saturn game.
What were they doing, making Burning Ranger or something?
Yeah. That's the answer.
Okay.
Finishing Knights and then making Burning Rangers.
Wow.
And then, yeah. Made this. So yeah, instead they just ported Sonic 1 through 3 and Knuckles to the Saturn, and it had this 3D sort of museum stage that you could run around as Sonic, and yes, like Bob said, it was a huge tease. but kind of cute too, because you could go to the different spots that held all the different archival materials. Like you'd go into this little hut, the movie theater hut, and it would take you underground into the movie theater, and you could watch like Sonic commercials and things, and rare animation from Japan, things that we may have talked about before.
Like the original Sega CD opening with the original song, I think was part of that too.
Yeah. And just weird Japanese commercials, like I said. Yuji Naka was really involved in programming and porting this stuff, because he still was at the time, still into those things. Like he personally added the spin dash to Sonic 1. And, this comes back, to recent times, a cute little anecdote in that, as M2 were making 3D Sonic 1 for the 3DS, they decided to email Naka, ask how he did that spin dash thing in Sonic 1.
It's a really good, port, by the way. Really
yes. Good. Yes, absolutely. So I just thought that was cute. Yeah. So I did buy Sonic Jam and I did really like that sort of 3D little stage. Yes, it was a huge tease and nothing much to it, but it was neat to run around in.
Yeah.
I didn't really mind so much that it wasn't a real Sonic game. I think I just like the idea of having an underground theater. Otherwise, you're just running around collecting rings for basically no reason in that thing. But, you know, it was cute. It was pretty good for the time. All right. So now let's just go ahead. Let's jump into Namco Museum. And...
All right.
The reason I enjoyed that series so much, and the reason that really I wanted to bring this up as a whole topic on this episode, is that there is a huge difference between these retro compilations that include more than just the games and the ones that just shove the games in there and call it a day. Hey, $30, go have fun. Namco Museum was very odd in that it was released fairly early in the PlayStation's life. This was like in 1995, I think, originally in Japan. And they just, it was a really big celebration of Namco stuff. They had the games, of course, but the big draw was this 3D first-person museum that every edition had. There was 5 volumes of Namco Museum and then a few extra ones that we can talk about. But you would go into this first-person museum as Pac-Man, I guess, because you would have a little representation of Pac-Man in the corner of the screen.
All right.
He was your first-person avatar. And you would go through these museums. You can go into the actual game rooms, and they would have these themed rooms, like the, you know, whatever, it'd be like a weird space theme with all the Galaga aliens flying around, for example. You would just go up and walk up to the cabinet or the cocktail cabinet and play the game that way, or you could just jump to the game normally. But also, there would be extra rooms, like as you entered the game room, you would have this sort of, this little tour of these stands, and they would show you like sprite sheets, and they would display like the arcade board or advertisements, anything like that. And it was just so cool to me in that you could just literally walk up and look at these things and browse them. And then you would go into this other separate room that would have, you know, the sound tests and like a hit, like a plaque with like the history of Namco games on it that you would scroll through. You could look at the old Namco fan club magazines, the covers of those that were released in Japan. I actually managed to get a couple finally when I last went to Japan. And I got some of those NG magazines. Like that's the crux of Namco Museum.
One of the neat things about that is that in 95, when the internet wasn't quite as pervasive as it is now, when I think that I didn't have all 5 volumes, but I definitely had the first one, and I think the second one. And that was my first exposure to a lot of that material. I was aware that it was extant, but right now, you know, I could Google image search those magazine covers, or I could go to YouTube and get those sound tests. I could use the internet as such, but this was kind of my first exposure to a lot of that.
But the difference is you don't get such a nice presentation to it. I mean, sure, this was really early PlayStation 3D. It was super rudimentary looking, but you know, they had nice spacey music to it as well, underlying it. And it felt real enough. Like, oh yeah, this is nice of them. Really?
Yeah. It was definitely a superior experience, and it was also novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it carried a lot of that idea where the future is going to be exploring virtual spaces. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's faster to just look up the information, you know, on your own, but the novelty of the 3D space, it wasn't necessarily full of enemies or whatever, was really interesting. Just like, yeah. I'm in a fake museum. I'm going to just walk around at my own leisure and look at whatever I want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then play a game if you want.
Yeah. They did a few really smart things with Namco Museum. And I think one of the smartest things they did was to approach it as a series. So rather than just, like, you know, throwing the 5 games you know about onto the first disc and then suddenly realizing, oh, we should do more of these. Let's put a bunch of crap on the rest, whatever we can dig up. They actually kind of spaced out the games that people like and spread it across the 5 discs. Well, you know, there were actually 6, but only 5 in the U.S. And, you know, that there was still a little bit of that sort of clustering. So that I think Namco Museum 1, 3, and 5 ended up going to the Greatest Hits collection.
Yeah.
So they were really easy to find. They sold best because they had Pac-Man on them and Galaga and Miss Pac-Man and, you know, all the games people really, really remembered. Volumes 2 and 4 were a little bit more obscure, and so they didn't, I guess, hit the threshold or just didn't seem worth reprinting under the Greatest Hits label. So they, you know, those were a little harder to come by. But, you know, altogether, like, there were some good games on each of the compilations, and there were also some obscure games on each of the discs. So if you bought one because, you know, you're like, oh, I love that game, I want to pick that up, you would inevitably discover some really strange things like the Genji and Heike clans, or trying to remember King and Balloon, like some just really, really off in the weed type stuff that I had never even heard of. And I, you know, spent a lot of time in the arcade playing a lot of these games, but some of them never made it to the US, and some of them were so obscure when they made it to the US that no one cared. You know, at the same time, I still feel like they kind of missed the boat a little bit by not picking up all the really super obscure, or I guess I should say midway developed Pac-Man games. Like, it would have been really great if they had put stuff like Professor Pac-Man and Baby Pac-Man on there, or Pac-Man Jr., whichever one wasn't the pinball game.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were some gaps. And it was always really frustrating to me that Namco Museum Encore, the 6th volume, never came to the U.S. because it had a couple of really, really great games on it, including Rolling Thunder, which is a personal favorite of mine. So you had to get that one only as an import. But you know, it was to me, it was worth it because there was no other way for me to play Rolling Thunder at that point. You know, having a modded PlayStation, I was okay spending $60 on that because where else was I going to play this game that I remember seeing in 1985 in an arcade? You know, that was like 10, 15 years before and had always wanted to play some more of. There was like a bad NES port.
Yeah, exactly. You probably wouldn't be satisfied with the Tengen version.
Yeah, without Namco Museum, I would not have never have been baffled by Tower of Jiraga.
Yeah.
It's like, what is this?
And,
what am I doing?
Yes. That's crazy because they included a little hint book.
Oh, okay.
That was in Volume 3.
Yeah, I think I did own that one at
and
one point.
Namco US, in their great generosity, made this tiny hint book that they just slipped into the case for Tower of Jiraga and told you how to get all the secret items and what the secrets were in each level. So that was really nice of them.
Oh, wow. Was that in the Greatest Hits version? Because I picked up that volume with Greatest Hits, and I don't remember that booklet.
Oh, well, I got Greatest Hits.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
No, dude. Oh.
I got screwed.
Oh, boy.
Maybe I bought mine used. I don't know.
Yeah. That might have been
how
it.
Tragic. So are we going to talk about Namco Anthology, or do you consider that kind of its own separate thing?
No, sure. I just wanted a couple more details before we move on to that. I just wanted to say that most of these games were not emulations. They were ports, and you can definitely see that when you play Pac-Man in Volume 1, because it's like this really weird like redraw of the arcade game.
Mm.
The sprites look very off, and it doesn't really feel the same. But most every other game in those collections are fairly accurate. Of course, they also went the extra mile by including like dip switch settings and things.
Right. And the cabinet art was around the screen, right?
I think
occasionally.
I remember
that. Okay.
Occasionally. Yeah. Mostly in the Pac-Man ones because it was just vertical screen.
Right. Yeah.
So they released 5 volumes. The 6th one was Namco Museum Encore only in Japan. And then, like Jeremy says, Namco Anthology. 2 volumes, I believe, also for PlayStation. They didn't have museums, the 3D museums, if I recall.
Yeah, they were more simplistic. Were those PC games? What were those exactly? I remember playing them and being really baffled. I was like, what are these games that I've never heard of before?
Like what?
you know, I can't even remember. Like, I picked those up. Those were also import only. And I, you know, I tried all the games on them and was just like, what the hell is this? And none of it stuck with me. It was all just like, some of them were really complicated games that needed more instructions in English than I had available at the time. So I was just a little baffled by them.
I just looked it up. Namco Anthology 1 had Star Luster, Tower of Babel, Wrestle Ball, and Conqueror's Continent. And those, the first two at least, were Famicom games. And then Namco Anthology 2 had Pack Attack.
Oh, right. Yeah. Pack Attack. I do remember.
Yeah. And the Valkyrino Boken, which was which one was that? The arcade one? No, that was the original Famicom game. Yeah, again.
Okay, so then, that was home ports. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. And then Namco Classic 2 golf game, and then King of Kings. So yeah, more focused on the console stuff. So yeah, maybe a 3D museum would not have been as exciting for those. But nonetheless, they released that, and yeah, they kept it up.
I would like to see the early stages of the Wrestle Balls.
Like, yeah.
How do we miss that on the wrestling episode?
I know.
I don't even know what it is.
I'm afraid to see images of it. Yeah.
There is so much to talk about.
I assume it's kind of like Blitzball, but you know, more like about up close contact and sweaty dudes groping each other.
yes. So, despite you know some of the weird parts of these collections, in my opinion, they are still basically the gold standard as far as like treating these games the way that, you know, they probably should be. The fact that you just have this explorable museum, it just blows my mind that nobody really ever attempted it again. Some of these things that we'll talk about later had like, you know, fake living rooms, but it's just like a very simple, you know, select things with a menu. It doesn't make any difference. Mm. It's not something you can actually freely walk around.
I think since then, compilations have suffered from commoditization, kind of like fighting games. You know, older fighting games, you had maybe 8 characters, 12 characters at most, and you learned them, and like each character seemed unique and was great. And then, you know, you started getting stuff like Mortal Kombat 3 Gold or whatever, where it had like 50 million characters, and they all are kind of the same, and it's really hard to feel attached to any, like, you know, to all the characters. I think it's kind of the same thing with compilations. Like, once upon a time, there was sort of this sense that, hey, here is something precious and valuable, and, you know, this is content. Whereas now, people just want as much content as possible for as cheaply as possible. And, you know, I think that's kind of the push-pull that you saw a generation later with the Sega Ages versus the Sega Genesis collection or whatever.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah. So Namco Museum was a real diamond in the rough in that sense. But apparently Namco realized that whole commoditization thing later, because there was a sort of second generation of Namco Museum that did not work out quite as well. So there was a bunch of post-PS1 ports to things like the N64, Dreamcast, GBA, GameCube, Xbox, PS2, and these were all basically handled by Western developers, especially some of them were made by Mass Media. And they're all pretty pukey. They take out all the museum stuff, and it's just quick and dirty ports of the ports. So, like, the weird-looking Pac-Man games are all there as well. And it's just, you know, it definitely has a greater cash-in feel than the original PS1 series. So yeah, not much to say there. However, there was another generation for more recent, the PSP series Namco Museum Battle Collection, much better handled. Again, no museum stuff, and at this point I don't need to say that, but they had a lot of the crazy games also from Encore. They had the King and Balloon, for example, I remember on the PSP game. Namco Museum DS, which was ported by M2, which great company, we'll talk about more, I'm sure. And those are emulations, and they don't look all that great on the DS screen. They have a bunch of different scaling options. Some don't look that great, but they do have different variations of games. You can play Super ZVS as opposed to ZVS, and you have different sorts of settings for Dig Dug or Dig Dug 2, what have you. And it also has like this navigator mode for certain games. Like if you play ZVS, it will have a map on the bottom screen showing you where all the secrets are, where to bomb to get the extra point towers and whatnot, and also hints for Tower of Draga. And so I think if anybody has the wherewithal to play Tower of Draga now, try it on MQ Museum DS, because you do get live hints as you play it, and it's a good way to learn that. It also includes a Pac-Man Versus, not necessarily a retro game, but it is a DS port of that GameCube game that was one of the big connectivity games back then, where you play as Pac-Man against three friends who are ghosts. You can play it wireless on the DS. I recommend that
as well. That's really fun. I'm surprised it hasn't come out like through eShop or whatever.
Yeah. Well, they are coming out with Pac-Man Battle Royale on Pac-Man Museum, which is a forthcoming release from Namco as well.
Okay.
And Pac-Man Battle Royale was a recent arcade game that, same principle, sort of, although you're all Pac-Man and you can also eat each other, and it's very fun. So look forward to that as well. But also,
the cabinet for that is beautiful. Mm-hmm. They have one at Ground Control in Portland, and it seems like the kind of object you would give as a gift if you were visiting a kingdom. Like it is so gorgeous. Drink holders and just, you know, so bright.
Well, that's why you're here, Gary, to give us those illusions like that. Yeah.
So something I noticed I don't really see in your notes, Ray, but I think it's worth mentioning that around this time, you know, the PlayStation era, Saturn era, like Japan went compilation crazy, and we saw very, very few of those compilations in the US. But yeah. I mean, Konami had their MSX collections for Saturn, where they would just put like 40 MSX games on a single disc, and there were like three collections of it. It was just completely ridiculous. They had like all their MSX games, except for some reason the Metal Gear games on there, which was kind of annoying. Like I bought them thinking, Metal Gear, but no. Capcom had the Capcom Classics collections, which was like five volumes, and they were all themed. So there was one that had the 1942, 1943, 1943 Kai, one that had all the Ghost and Goblin series, one that had Street Fighter. And did you play any of these? Any of you?
I didn't, no.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I know about them.
Yeah. So there was like one that was all Ghost and Goblins games, one that was all 1942 games, one that was Street Fighter, and that actually did make it over a Street Fighter collection or whatever for PlayStation.
But
there were a bunch of those, and they were done individually for both PlayStation and Saturn, and those were really great. They also did the Mega Man PS1 ports, the Rockman Complete Works.
Yeah.
And they had the audacity to release each individual NES Mega Man game is a separate PlayStation game, but
so
they added a bunch of extra stuff to it. Like, you know, there was Pocket Station games, and there was the navigation mode. There were museum pieces and graphics and just a lot of extra stuff. So it didn't feel like a total ripoff.
I think that's all in the PS2 and Xbox versions of the Mega Man collection, but maybe not the GameCube. I know that they had to cut stuff from the GameCube version, like maybe the remixed music you can optionally turn on. Something was cut out of the GameCube.
It was kind of hit and miss. PSN actually has some of these as import games, but I think they only released the first four and didn't bother to release five and six because stupidity. I don't know.
Yeah, that's really odd.
There were even more obscure collections. Like I think Broderbund had a collection, including the Famicom version of Blaster Master on one of them. You could get like a compilation with Crazy Climber. I don't know. There were a bunch of them that, you know, were hard to come by or I didn't know about until much later, at which point I didn't really care as much because classic games were more of a commodity. But like there were just tons and tons of classic compilations in Japan. There was Zanuck X Zanuck, which was the old Zanuck games, plus a totally new Zanuck game that was completely great.
Yeah, and that was like one of the last PS1 releases, I think.
Yep. Yeah, it was just a like a really, really sort of rich sub-scene in Japan, and most of that never quite made it over here, which is really disappointing.
Yeah. There's also the Jolico collections, Sunsoft Memorial collections.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Sunsoft. Yeah, mostly just Famicom games and things. Yeah.
Right.
The thing also with those MSX collections is that they were released also fairly early into those consoles' lives. And they're all like the MSX1 games, so they're all really the cruddy ones, relatively.
Yep.
Yeah. But yeah, for sure. The thing is that, you know, I didn't have a lot of hands-on experience with those, so I didn't really feel like mentioning them. But yes, you are right. That was a big boom that I should have probably mentioned. So thank you.
Absolutely. That was when I was really getting into importing. So I kind of had my eye on those things. And I imported, you know, some of the stuff that I was familiar with, like the Capcom games, Mega Man. There was a short while where the Babbages, where I lived, had a big section of Saturn import games that no one bought. Mm-hmm. So then they cleared them out for like $15 a piece. So I got the MSX collections and nice. Other random stuff for like crazy low prices. So that was really great. But it was kind of frustrating that we didn't see more of those games over here.
It does bring up the question of like, you know, did these companies just not believe in it anymore? I mean, again, we had these collections going on the PC for years and years, but when it came to like the console editions, maybe there's more involved in it. I mean, did have to deal with like a manufacturer certification, that sort of red tape. Maybe that was just part of the problem where it was just like, yeah, maybe it's not so worth it. So, but hey,
it could be. And
we got the five Namco museums.
Yeah. As I noted, the, you know, those early compilations for consoles tended to package, you know, one to five games at most.
Yeah.
Whereas on PC, like from the very beginning, there were just huge compilations, tons of games. So I don't know if it was necessarily something to do with space limitations. I doubt it. But maybe just, you know, the console business has always been different than the PC business. And I think publishers really like creating a sense of value. I mean, we still see it with, you know, with Nintendo games and with like the Dragon Quest games, or at least they turned into crappy mobile ports.
Yeah.
Like the idea that, hey, this is a premium product. We can't give you too many of these because, you know, you just can't handle that much at once. So what we really need for you to do is buy all these games across several products because they're worth it. And you know that they're worth it. So come on and dig deep. Whereas on PC, it's just like, whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, piracy has always been much easier on PC and... you know, like C64 games, I think probably were as likely to be played from downloading them from a BBC or borrowing them from a friend's copy disc.
Did anybody buy a C64
game? Someone must have.
Yeah.
Which I'm gonna say is,
console games piracy was much more difficult. And I think it's just been like there has always been kind of this staggered sense of value between the two platforms. And that's not a criticism of PCs. I think it's just sort of the reality of how people treat those games and, you know, just the nature of the machines themselves.
Yeah. As Jeremy was saying about the nature of PC and console compilations, I didn't get a PC in our house until the mid-90s, but in the late 90s, it was like this golden age of re-releases, like not just LucasArts, but Sierra and Electronic Arts was releasing their old catalog. I remember they were selling almost all of Bullfrog's games for $10 each in these little tiny stationery style boxes that had these gold borders. And if you bought two of them, I think you got a free one via mail.
Yeah.
So I bought like Theme Park and Syndicate and a bunch of other old Electronic Arts games.
Wow.
In the late 90s for super cheap. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, they were big on compilations. Just like, okay, here's every King's Quest game. Here's every Leisure Suit Larry game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a good time.
It wasn't always great either. In the early kind of 2000s, that's how I stumbled across the Gold Box games, the old D&D games. They did a compilation of all of them. And a lot of the text and kind of flavor and backstory was in the manual. So you'd get to a point in the game and it'd say, reference this page in the manual. It's kind of a half copy protection, half space saving measure. And on the compilation version, they would have the manuals for all of the games as a text file, which is all well and good. But,
you know,
do you just print this all out? Do you print out, you know, hundreds of pages of D&D manuals?
BYOP.
Yeah, exactly.
The Gabriel Knight Collection came with a novel that I never read.
Yeah, and a comic book.
Okay.
And a soundtrack. That was one of those little proprietary players. Like, it wasn't MP3s. You would put it in and there would be this little...
Oh, okay. Like the Sierra Media Player version 2.0.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I bought mine on eBay, so I think it was missing that.
Just to quickly end the Namco Museum part, there were other versions of it more recently. Namco Museum Essentials for PS3. That is only a few games, but it also has a couple of remixes of games as well, which was also a big thing on the PSP version. They made these remixed versions, which became almost standard now for Namco Museum later on. Namco Museum Virtual Arcade for Xbox 360. That had some of the games that were already on Xbox Live Arcade, but they added like Mr. Driller and Tower of Druaga and a couple of others, I think, that were not on Arcade originally. But, you know, despite those ones not having the museum bonuses, they are better handled than the previous ones that were done by Mass Media and others. So, I mean, now, you know, on this current previous gen, whatever you want to call it, like, you know, you can get a pretty good sampling of Namco games that are well done. So there were other offshoots, like there was Pac-Man Collection on GBA and Pac-Man and Galaga Dimensions, also recently on 3DS, basically just like it says, Pac-Man and Galaga, and also the DX versions. And you know, it's on 3DS, so you have like a 3D view of a cocktail table and a little stack of coins that looks 3D and it pops up at you. Fantastic. Thanks for that.
Wow.
You know, I think something worth mentioning about the Namco Museum series, you know, that sort of trend of compiling old Namco games, is that they've kind of become essential to understanding the bizarre mythology that Namco has built to unify, like, its entire console or arcade video game history. I played Namco Museum around the time that I was playing Mr. Driller. And, you know, at some point I discovered that not only was Dig Dug supposed to be Mr. Driller's father, but that his mother was Kissy from Baraduke.
That's right.
And, like, so then I started, you know, I played the Mr. Driller, what was it called? Drill Land for GameCube.
Yeah, yeah.
Which starts throwing all these references in. And, you know, knowing those, like, old video games helped me understand, like, what the hell, like, who are these people? Why are they showing up? And, yeah, so, like, Mr. Driller is kind of the nexus of the entire Namco universe, and apparently now Galaga fits into that, and, like, that whole, what is it called, Shifty Look comic series that whoever's doing with Namco, like, ties Galaga in there and a bunch of other franchises, or a bunch of, series into one big interconnected universe.
Sort of.
A little weird.
Yeah, yeah.
How does Wonder Momo fit in there?
I don't know. I don't think that's really canon yet.
And when Namco met Capcom, there was so much interbreeding. It went out of control. Yeah.
Side note, though, that whole thing with Mr. Driller's parents, it just warms my heart. I just love that they brought back these two characters.
You're just happy they found love?
And and their childhood Mr.
Like,
Driller.
Dig Dug makes sense, but Kissy from Baraduke? Like, who the hell knew what Baraduke was? Or that that character had a name?
Yeah.
But that was kind of interesting because that was a year before Metroid, and you had this space adventure kind of exploratory shooter, and inside the armor was a female character.
Yeah. Mm.
It was innovation that no one remembers.
Yep. Anyway, that's just one of my favorite things in video games. Let's move on. You know, Jeremy was mentioning the PS1 sort of little boom of classic compilations, and there was another one of sorts on GBA as well for a couple of years. This includes, like I said, there was an Amco Museum on GBA, a couple of them, and those other collections. There was also a Konami Arcade Advanced, which was just ports, again, of a couple few simple Konami arcade games. Time Pilot, Frogger, Gyrus, you know the rest. And then also, like was also mentioned, the NES ports. Not just Nintendo's separate NES Classic series, but a whole bunch of other compilations from other companies that sort of coincided with this NES emulator appearing on GBA. So I'm including like the NES games in the original Animal Crossing on GameCube. That was part of them, which you could send to the GBA. There was also the e-reader NES games. Those things that you had to very slowly scan into the e-reader, very carefully.
I'm a sucker. I bought those.
Yeah, well, of course. Why not? And if you're careful
enough, $5, you can play golf if you swipe 10 cards through a reader.
Yes. And other mundane classes.
God forbid you lose one.
Yes. but also in Japan, much like on PS1, again, you had companies like Hudson making compilations of like themed packs. You had the Adventure Island collection for Game Boy Advance. You had Star Soldier games.
Yeah.
Yeah. All four Adventure Islands.
Yeah, I had that, and I gave it to someone or sold it or something. I don't remember. And I really regret that now because, one, it was awesome, and two, it's like super rare and valuable now.
Yeah.
I'm an idiot.
Well, just goes to show, never sell anything. Culture Brain released like their Kung Fu Heroes or Ninja Boy games, those collections. Super Chinese Land. I just didn't want to say it, but it just sounds weird calling it what it is. The Super Chinese Land God games. Ray. Yeah, sorry. It's not my fault.
I gotta go.
Come on. Jolico released a collection. There's a collection of Kunio games on GBA as well. And then in the US, they released Capcom Mini Mix, which was three NES games, Bionic Commando, Mighty Final Fight, and oh my god, I'm free. Oh, Strider, yes. Strider and
Strider,
NES.
Yeah. Now, did they release that in Japan? Because the NES Strider never went to Japan.
And, no, I don't think they did.
Oh, man. They could have repatriated it.
Yeah.
Alas.
Yeah. US only, as far as I know. Very interesting, yeah. Of course, the downfall, I think, of at least that collection was that you couldn't really save. There's no added save functions.
Yeah, and also, I don't know, like, the GBA resolution wasn't true to NES resolution, so all those NES games, they ported them by, like, reducing lines of graphics. It was like every eighth line they would just strip out. So everything got squished and became kind of imprecise. I remember playing Zelda on the NES Classics and had a really hard time of it because, like, the whole thing just felt off. Like, it really threw me. And the precision was reduced.
Parts of Link's face would disappear periodically, just depending on which way you're facing. I didn't like that.
Yeah, it was really sort of a it-gets-the-job-done sort of situation. Mm. But there was a homebrew NES emulator for GBA as well that could, you know, you could switch the...
Scale it?
Scale the backgrounds or the sprites however you wanted to try and make it look as good as you possibly could. I don't know why that popped up exactly. I guess because Nintendo was like, hey, we made an emulator, now go have fun with it. Hmm. And all these developers decided to jump on the bandwagon.
That was really them using us as beta testers for Virtual Console. Like, will people buy these games if we try to sell them? Oh, they will. Well, let's do that.
Yeah. And Nintendo themselves, you know, the Famicom miniseries was well-treated enough, not necessarily technically, but they did have those nice tiny boxes that tried to replicate the original game boxes. And then, you know, on, I think, Club Nintendo, you could buy these giant collection cases for all of them. Yep. So, you know, they treated those as well as they could. And, of course, those are worth a lot of money.
The really great thing about that was the Famicom Disk Systems actually games, the Famicom Disk System games actually came in little acetate packages. And then inside, there was like a much smaller box containing the game. It was just like the most exquisite miniature dollhouse nonsense. But it was like also functional video game packaging. It was really crazy. I loved the amount of work they put into that. And I was really sad that that didn't translate over into the US. We just got like, you know, standard NES or Game Boy Advance packages.
Oh, God, yeah.
Bitmapped NES art.
No, they tried to like rejigger the box arts into like all the black box templates of the very first NES game.
So yeah, which lost the appeal of something like Castlevania, which was appealing because it had that amazing silver Konami box art that they used as their branding for a while.
Yeah. Or Zelda's gold box art. It's like, no, great. Yeah. Now it's a wonderful shade of black. Thanks. And thanks, Nintendo. I think we would have got the message if you just retained the original art somehow. So that's the GBA stuff. And, I mean, there was also, there was also Sega arcade collections. And sorry, Bob, we'll get to you.
Okay, no problem.
There were more Sega collections like the Arcade Gallery, which had Outrun, Super Hang-On, and Space Harrier. And then Phantasy Star Collection.
Yeah, just 2 and 3, though.
No, 1 through 3.
One through 3, you're right. Yeah. No, 4, though. That was the...
I guess it was too big or something.
Yeah.
Still pretty good. I mean, good relatively.
The original Phantasy Star, like, didn't it have a save bug that would melt your hardware or something? It was something some kind like of, like, major bug with saving on the original Phantasy Star that collection.
Yeah, they weren't emulations. I guess they were appealing at face value, let's say. Okay, Bob, I'm sorry.
I just want to bring up Game & Watch collections.
Yes,
they were more like Mario All-Stars in that they redid the graphics.
You mean the Game Boy Gallery?
Oh, are they called Gallery?
Game & Watch Gallery? Watch Gallery.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, I had one of the words wrong. But it was like they took these things that on their own were not like an interesting value proposition in the 90s. Yeah. Like, let's play Ball. Was one of them just called Ball?
Yeah.
Or like it.
Or like Manhole.
Octopus. And,
yeah, Octopus. I mean, like, I would not pay for one of those, you know, on its own, but as part of a collection and with, you know, throwing all the Nintendo characters in there and putting new music in and things like that, there were like maybe 5 games per collection?
Something like it. Yeah. 5 games in one.
And I think
unlockables as well.
Right. Extra and ones. Like, I don't know how popular Game & Watch was here, but it felt like they were sort of banking on nostalgia that wasn't as big, you know, here as it was in Japan.
But they did help that by making the remakes as well.
Right.
And, you know, give it modern Game Boy graphics. And yeah, I actually love that series quite a bit. I have all of them, and it also has, they all have really great Game Boy music. Great music for Game Boy games.
And I love Mario Cement Factory on its own, so it's fun to have a different version of that.
Some of them, I mean, they are kind of repetitive, and they do get progressively harder, so I mean, you don't probably spend as much time with them as you could. But yeah, I mean, that was also a really good example of a nice treatment of these classic games.
Yeah.
There was Game & Watch Collection on DS.
Around the same time that the Game & Watch galleries were coming out, Konami actually released compilations of like early Game Boy games as single cartridges. I think there were 3 or 4 of them.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because ROM sizes grew so much, they just shoved like the Castlevania Adventure and I don't remember what else on there.
Some of those were like MSX ports as well.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I never bought those because those were like UK only, and so Japan. I knew about them and I was deeply envious of them, but they were never affordable.
Hmm.
So I was always kind of a little bummed out by that. And also, I don't think it's on your list, but Konami released a compilation, an arcade compilation on DS that was really, really good. Like, very solidly programmed, even though the resolutions weren't quite right.
Yeah. You know why?
And why is that?
Made by M2.
M2? Yeah. The thing I loved about that was that they did all this crazy stuff with the bottom touchscreen. Like, you could use it to adjust dip switches for the game and just like, go totally hog wild. I think it was made kind of in the same spirit as the Namco collection for DS, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much at the same time.
Those were both really great.
Yeah, that's true. I thought I had it on my list, but I didn't. So thank you again, Jeremy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's move out of that portable space. Let's talk about Activision Anthology, which was on PS2. That was the flagship version. It was on other systems. But this put in pretty much every Activision/iMagic 2600 game, plus some homebrew games and some unreleased games. So in terms of volume, this was a pretty impressive package. And they kind of went a bit crazy with the whole, oh, this is in the 80s thing, because while they didn't have a virtual museum necessarily, they had a virtual living room that would play licensed music, over, like old classic 80s hits over it. I mean, not the worst approach, I guess, but better than just like a carousel of arcade cabinets that you could select from. I mean, other companies did that, and that was pretty lame. But yeah, Activision Anthology, it got a lot of respect for that. And, you know, it's not too hard to replicate 2600 games even on a PS2. How about that? So Yeah, it was pretty good. They also ported that, I believe. Well, they sort of ported it to PSP. There was like Activision Hits, sort of a reboot of the Windows series on there as well. I don't know if you guys ever played Activision Anthology or any experience with it.
I haven't.
But yeah, also in that virtual living room, it had like this wooden carousel of game cartridges. It looked like, you know, the old classic accessory that you can buy in the store or something.
That's where you store your 8-tracks.
Yes, too. Yes, exactly. That's what I was thinking of. Yeah, like an 8-track holder, but with the cartridges inside instead. So yeah, great stuff. I think it's worth looking at if you still want to, if you still have a PS2, that is, and want to check that out. Let's see. So now we're getting a little bit later into the 2000s. We have things like the Sega Genesis Collection, you know, and also Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection, kind of the same thing for PS2 and then PS3 and 360. Like we said, both done by Digital Eclipse / Backbone. They did shove a lot of games into these, and they did have some extra bits in it, like developer interviews on video. Not the best sorts of interviews, not a lot of insight in them, but, you know, they tried, and the games, again, were not super great emulations if you're the purist type.
Yeah.
But, like I said, I guess the volume sort of wins out in that sense, and, you know, they probably made some money. I know all the Sonic's collection, you know, that went greatest hits on both systems, and so you can still find that at Best Buy. Similarly, though, Backbone also kind of worked on Capcom Classic Collection 1 and 2 for PlayStation and Xbox, and they're all right as well. They're kind of the same sort of setup, and they have a bunch of different Capcom games from different eras. However, Volume 2, Capcom Classic Collection 2, I like because they have an alternate version of Quiz and Dragons that is all Capcom trivia. So you have the original arcade game, Quiz and Dragons. It's a fantasy-themed quiz game, which is like the only one that anybody ever translated into English, basically. And then they put in this alternate version with all this Capcom trivia from different games, and it's kind of neat. It's kind of neat that way.
So with those Capcom collections, I think I own at least one of them. Didn't you have to play a slot machine to unlock new games?
That is on the PSP one. Reload.
Yeah. Okay, I knew one of them.
Do you have to play the slot machine to unlock the games, or can you just unlock them faster that way? I think there are like in-game goals you have to hit to unlock some of the games.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
I'm wrong, but it is a little weird, but I do think those are actually pretty solid ports, the PSP versions especially. Like,
yes.
I appreciate the fact that they give you a lot of display options. It's kind of unusually varied and involved for a contemporary backbone game. Like, you know, for some of the shooters that had the vertically oriented screen, you can actually put your PSP in Tate mode and play it with the kind of the proper proportions for your screen instead of having to crunch everything down. And it's a little awkward, but it's not nearly as awkward as turning a television on its side. So on the whole, it's not that bad. Like, I appreciate that they made the effort, and I played through like the history of Capcom, like the first 3 years of Capcom, sort of in chronological order a couple of years ago with the PSP ports on Vita, and had a really good time with it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. That is Capcom Classics Collection Remixed and Reloaded for PSP. No, I'm sorry, Gary, go ahead.
No, it's just I didn't know whether you were moving on from the Capcom Classics.
Not yet.
Or not. The console versions of those, if I recall correctly, I think that it had, some of the kind of bonus material was unlocked under kind of achievements.
Yes.
Does that sound familiar?
Okay. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
It was kind of neat. Like you would, you know, oh, if you pick up the gun from the boss of Final Fight, you know, you unlock this little bit of art.
Yeah. The art was pretty much the driver there. It's just like, you progressively unlock bits of art and things.
Yeah. I thought that was really neat.
Yeah.
Just kind of gamification of the collection itself.
Of course, you can also just use a cheat code and unlock everything. Or on PSP, just download a save. That unlocked everything. Yeah. Funny note about Reloaded on PSP. That was actually made in Japan as opposed to being from Backbone. So I don't know. I don't know why they switched that in the middle of it. But yeah. That was the one with the slot machine. But like I said, just download a save. You can, it doesn't matter anymore. It has all the Ghosts and Goblins on there as well. It's pretty good. That was Capcom's whole treatment, and they've done stuff in recent times, but I have a section on that later on. Now we move on to the Sega Ages 2500 series, which is this weird sort of three-pronged thing. It started with the remakes of the classic games by Sega and D3 Publisher, because the 2500 is a reference to the simple 2500 series that D3 Publisher had made in Japan, and it's these very cheap knockoffy games, and so why not bring that to some Sega arcade classics? And so you have these...
They made some cheap knockoffs of Sega that were official Sega games.
Yes.
How many of these came out here? I know there were like a smattering...
All of them came out here in something called Sega Classic Collection.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
On PS2.
I'm jumping ahead of things.
No, that's fine. No, no, you're not. Okay. That's perfectly fine.
I recall like Altered Beast is bad enough, but there's just like a even worse.
Golden Axe.
Well, Golden Axe is the one.
Terrible,
that you have. Yeah, yeah.
Weird sort of remake of Golden Axe.
Like the 3D remake of Monaco GP that still plays like a 1981 arcade racer.
Yes.
Even though it has blocky polygons. So bad.
To be fair, there are at least two highlights. The Fantasy Zone remake is all right, and the Virtua Racing port is pretty good. Probably the best console port of that game. And that is all. Those are all on Sega Classics Collection in the U.S. And probably Europe.
And I know they remade Phantasy Star 1.
That's right. Okay, those were not included. But
yeah, I was wondering, like, some of them weren't. And that Phantasy Star remake always, like, really tempted me because I wanted to play the game, you know, in a more modernized form.
Yeah, but it kind of looks... cheap anyway.
It does, yeah.
It has that high resolution 2D sprite problem where it's just like everything looks papery.
Right, right, yeah.
So, someone will come along and make it a terrible version for iOS.
Oh, thank God.
Soon enough. Oh, just you wait.
Can I pay $18 for it, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I'm glad you asked.
Just had to say it, didn't you, Gary? Yeah. Just had to friggin' say it.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah,
I remember these somewhat well because they started launching those in Japan right around the time that 1UP was still in its infancy and we were just, you know, experimenting with different kinds of content. So I think Dave Smith and Nick Maragos imported those and just pissed all over them because, I mean, they deserved it. They were terrible. Like the first four volumes, if you dig somewhere in a 1UP's archives, there'll be like a broken HTML page that has reviews of these because the tech of the site changed a few times and left behind that old stuff in kind of unreadable form. But like, even if you can't read the whole thing all the way through, you get the vitriol. Like, you really feel it.
Yes. I do remember those, yeah. Sad times. But then they made, like, a second series of this Sega Ages collection, and these were all actual emulated compilations from the great people at M2. So you had collections.
I'm going to have to change my vote. These are the best classic compilations ever. I will put my money on that. Like, just in terms of content... and in presentation and in thoroughness, like these, you know, five or six that M2 did were just like, they are the pinnacle. So please go on. I just want to express my love for them right now.
And these are the ones that didn't come out in America as much. Correct.
No, unfortunately, never. No.
Yeah. So jealous.
So you had collections for Phantasy Star 1 through 4 and everything else. You had a treasure collection, which was centered on Gunstar Heroes, but basically had every notable treasure game on Genesis. You had Galaxy Force, and then Phantasy Zone, Space Harrier, and those all have different bonuses to them as well. Like Space Harrier is technically a Space Harrier 2 collection, but it actually has every sort of version you could wish for. And then Phantasy Zone is funny because M2 actually ported Phantasy Zone 2 to an older set of hardware. Like, they made an arcade port of Phantasy Zone 2 that never existed before. Because Phantasy Zone 2 was only on Master System, so they made an enhanced 16-bit arcade version and then put that on PS2. Mm. Craziness. Crazy passion from those people.
I mean, the content in those things is just amazing because, so for like the Wonder Boy collection, not only does it have every Wonder Boy game and every Monster Land or Monster World game, it also has like every version of those games. So for the original Wonder Boy game, you have the arcade game, you have the Master System game, and then you have the Sega SG-1000 version of the game.
Yeah.
There's like all kinds of museum content. For Phantasy Star, it has not only the classic Phantasy Star games, but also Phantasy Star Gaiden for Game Gear, and then it has the text adventure games.
Oh, God. Wow.
That were then like showed up on the I think the Saturn compilation of Phantasy Star.
Yeah.
Like, it's amazing how much content and material they dug up. Like, those guys are so good. I mean, of course they're the ones behind the 3DS games that Sega's been publishing, but like everything they do just turns to gold. It's so good.
Yeah, we salute them. not only do they have like different versions, but also regional versions. So if there's mm-hmm. something different in the US or European version, include that
or
too.
Or if you just want to play, if there's a localized game and you want to play it in English, you just switch the version over to play it in English. Mm-hmm.
And helpful things like, I believe, like a fast forward for Phantasy Star games. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah. They tweaked some balance stuff in Phantasy Star 1. Craziness. Just craziness. And a couple of them are actually on the Japanese PSN now as well. So if anybody wants to get the easiest way to get those.
And I think a semi-complete version of that Monster World compilation is on XBLA. It has at least three or four of the games, but it's M2 still, right?
Part of the rebooted Vintage Collection. Yeah. Not as complete, but yes, still pretty good. And I guess that's a good segue into what I would like to call highlights of recent times.
Mm.
Very, very recent arcade and console compilations.
Highlights for kids, if you will.
Sure.
Goofus releases games in their improper aspect ratio.
Yes, indeed. So there was the Sega Vintage Collection reboot because Backbone had made these separate Genesis ports and they called it Sega Vintage Collection. People hated it. That's what we already talked about. But then M2 came back and made what was called in Japan Sega Ages Online. But over here, they just renamed into Sega Vintage Collection. So we had the collections of the Wonder Boy games and compilation of Alex Kidd and then Super Hang-On and Space Harry, I believe it was. But and Toe Jam and Earl. Toe Jam and Earl, mm-hmm. I don't know why Japan appreciates Toe Jam and Earl so much. I mean, I love it. It's a great series. But it's just nice to have M2 sort of put their hands on that series. So those are great. I mean, we've all played it. I mean, for sure, get Monster World 4 at least.
Oh, yeah.
My God. I mean, these are released separately on PS3, not on Xbox for some reason, but all you really need is Monster World 4 if you have to get anything. For sure.
I agree with this.
Yes. Also, M2 made Capcom Arcade Cabinet, which is different Capcom early days arcade games, and by that I mean stuff that was sort of like pre-Street Fighter 2, pre-CPS system stuff. So you had things like Volgus, their first game there, and Higemaru, just all those sorts of Sun, and you can buy those in separate DLC packs. Maybe not the greatest model there, but...
Higemaru, was that the pirate game?
Yeah,
Pirate Ship Higemaru. Secretly the prequel to Goof Troop.
Yes.
Factoid.
Yes, indeed.
I'm not even kidding.
No. Some of them are, like Higemaru's alright. Some of them are not too, memorable. Maybe, if you're a Japanese nerd for this stuff, maybe it's a good idea to go ahead and download them. But, nevertheless, treated well because it's M2. Also the Neo Geo Station, also done by M2. They ported some Neo Geo games to PS3 and PSP. Also very accurate. Check those out. There's Vectrex Regeneration on iOS, which is done by this little development team. And they sort of treated the Vectrex as Activision did with their 2600 games in Anthology, is that they sort of made this virtual living room. They can go around. You can play different Vectrex games. It also has like homebrew games. And that's pretty neat. I don't remember how much it was exactly, but if you really like Vectrex and you can stand the fact that it's not actually a vector monitor, go ahead and check it out. There's some good games to play there.
Yeah, I actually had never heard of Vectrex Regeneration. This is a shock to me. I didn't realize that existed.
Yeah, well, much like everything else on iOS, it got buried. So,
oh, of course.
Check it out. It's on Universal app. Works on anything. Looks great. There was a recent Japanese release for 3DS called J Legend Retsuden, and that is a compilation of all the different, Shonen Jump games that were made by Bandai. And, most of them are crap. Let's not mince words, but, I don't know.
Is one of those games Dragon Power?
Yes.
Okay.
The original, some of the Dragon Ball games, but they did include some Super Nintendo games like a Go Go Ackman 3. That was just another Toriyama series that you may not have heard of, but that was an alright platformer. And it was just odd because it was just like an anniversary collection of these console games on 3DS. If you have any sorts of nostalgia or interest in that, I would check that out. There is NES Remix. Now, this is not really a compilation in the traditional sense that we've been discussing, but I did want to bring it up because it raises an interesting question about where these sorts of collections could go. Mm. Because it's not the full games. You're just playing these piecemeal sorts of achievement-y type of tasks for these different games. And it's really interesting. You know, I mean, Nintendo could have just, you know, threw them onto a disc or something, or if they wanted to. Not that anybody would like that, because who wants to really play Cuckoo Land that much again on a separate disc?
If I could be obnoxious, I can say these are classic games for the YouTube generation.
Yes, sure.
You can no longer say MTV generation. Just like no more than 20 seconds of your attention at a time. Yeah. But I like how they were cut up.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there is a lot to go through as well, because they also make these remix stages, and on top of all the dozens of different task missions you do for the regular games, you have these remix missions that tweak the gameplay and add sorts of funky effects to things. Like, you can play Link in Donkey Kong and you can't jump. Ha ha ha. Cute things like that.
Yeah.
And this was developed by IndieZero, who made Retro Game Challenge on DS, so they're in their wheelhouse here for sure. But yeah, what do you guys think about that? Like, this is where we're going, the YouTube generation sort of thing.
I would argue that there is something smarter happening at work in NES classics than just, like, let's break it down into little pieces so people who play Angry Birds can understand it. Like, you know, there is a design vocabulary in the best of Nintendo's games. Maybe not an Urban Champion, but you know, like, these games work on an internal logic and they kind of teach you as they go along, and that's something I've really enjoyed just kind of analyzing and breaking down and writing about. And effectively what NES Classics does is it takes those games and it breaks down those lessons into discrete chunks. So what you're kind of playing is like little pieces of what the video games try to teach you as you play them. And, you know, the original games just have all those things kind of contiguous, but here they break it out so it becomes almost tutorial-like. And the way that the NES Classics the game sections are structured is that you kind of progressively pick up these abilities, you know, you kind of have to master individual challenges and then you start to synthesize them. And then at the end of each game's set of challenges, you're pretty much playing a level and putting all those things together.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think that's a pretty smart way to go about it. And it's not like they're just sort of arbitrarily creating random, you know, challenges for the hell of it. Like there is, like, these things are already extant in the games, and they're just kind of breaking it out and making it more obvious and turning it into kind of standalone goals. And I don't know, I really enjoyed NES Classics and really, really hope that we see more of those.
I don't think they're so cynical as to say, like, this will appeal to those dumb kids who can't pay attention to anything. But at the same time, some of those remix levels do feel like iOS versions of the games. Like, there are a few Mario levels where it is basically like Cannibalt, where you're just touching one button.
Right.
And I could see that being like a Nintendo iOS game if that ever happened, if that dark day ever comes upon us. But yeah, I mean, I love it. I love the NES Remix. But this is kind of slightly off topic. I'm kind of done with 8-bit nostalgia. I'm ready to move on to like 16-bit nostalgia, but it would take more work to do, so I understand why they always retreat to 8-bit stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and plus, you know, the real love for Nintendo in Japan comes from the Famicom era.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's ultimately what they're tapping back into. Like, over and above everything else, what they are doing is pandering to, like, 30 to 40-year-olds who grew up playing Famicom games and think back fondly on those things. Like, it's just kind of a naked grab for their affection and to say, hey, remember this? You love it. You still love it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Gary, have you played NES Remix?
I have not. No, I haven't touched a Wii U before.
Get out.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. It sounds really interesting, and especially, you know, being done by the same people who did Retro Game Challenge.
Yeah.
One of the things I thought about when I saw this topic was, I wish that there was more done with these kind of false collections.
Yeah.
Like, Retro Game Challenge is really, it's one of my favorite games of all time. And I would love to see, you know, even without necessarily the license or the set dressing, just kind of, this is an alternate history, like just a fake compilation. We've made all of these, but they still kind of plot a course and stand up as experiences on their own.
Yeah.
I would love to see a little bit more kind of meta exploration of this idea.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of a non-starter of a trend back when Retro Game Challenge came out, because I remember some cell phone game in Japan as well that sort of did the same thing. And then there was Dark Void Zero, which wasn't that great, as you know, I mean, didn't really treat things as well as it could have, I think. So in terms of like faithfulness, Retro Game Challenge is certainly up there. And when they apply that sort of designed to something like NES Remix, it works out pretty well. So yeah, I mean, we've run through so much already, and I apologize for dominating the conversation for you guys. I don't know if you have anything else you'd like to mention, Bob, Gary, Jeremy.
I can't think of, I mean, those Mega Man compilations, like, do we approve of them? Do we disapprove? I thought they were a great...
Mega Man collection, anniversary collection, yeah, it's all right. I would, like, the Xbox version is the best one. I mean, these are ports of the PS1 Complete Works collection.
Right.
And, like, they have that navigation mode in it, not the Pocket Station stuff, obviously. So, they're all right.
Yeah. And the arcade games, too, if you care about those.
And Mega Man X collection has Battle and Chase, the... Mega Man card game.
Which you shouldn't care about. But
no, it almost came out here, though.
Yeah. There are ads for it, right?
Yes.
Okay, thought so.
Yeah, in recent times, I really like the re-release of the arcade Dungeons & Dragons
yes.
games. Yes.
That's a really great treatment. And yeah.
And that is weird, actually, because the Japanese version of that was made internally by Capcom, whereas it's a different product, basically. It's the same games, but a different product. And that is a great collection, no matter what you get.
Yeah, they did a good job with the extras, and they made it effortless to play online with people, so you can kind of simulate that arcade experience really easily.
Yeah. The version over here was made by Iron Galaxy, and they were porting, like, the other old arcade fighters from Capcom as well. And they would add, like, those achievement tracker things. And, yeah, they add good netcode. I think pretty much all use GGPO netcode platform for that. So yeah, good stuff. And I recommend those as well. All right. I guess I have some, I wrote down some scattershot questions here. I mean, I was like, wouldn't it be great if we had these things? Like, what if there was a new full blown Namco museum with modern graphics and more archival material? What if it supported Oculus Rift, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
A VR Namco museum. I would never leave the house. One thing I think is a big gap in a lot of these compilations that there's not a lot of attention paid to, like, the old computer platforms, like the Atari 8-bit systems, the Amstrad stuff. I mean, sure, we have, like, ZX Spectrum things on iOS, and these things come and go, but there's other cool games that were on older platforms that were not all synthesized into DOS or Windows that, you know, are worth playing, I think. So it's too bad. I guess it's just how the cookie crumbles. And, you know what? Wouldn't it be nice if M2 made everything?
Yeah. Here's my idea.
Yes.
Like, the Library of Congress preserves certain works in literature and film and whatever. The government should buy M2 and make them an institution that preserves video games. That's my, like, crazy dream for the future. Wow. It will never happen, but
yeah, as long
maybe before I die, video games will get respect enough to do that.
Yes.
Hopefully.
As long as they are given free reign.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And, that's really about it. Just a few questions to think about as we, go out on this. Like I said, this is one of my favorite topics, and it was a good excuse to talk about Namco Museum, as I've said.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Bob, and Gary, and Jeremy.
Yay!
And, of course, you for listening. You can catch us on Retronauts.com. You can find this episode, of course. You can find some relevant links, if I ever find any, and, you know, you can, look at our other episodes. You can find us on Twitter, on Retronauts, and Facebook as well, on Retronauts. Do we have anything else in the hopper that we should talk about?
Shirts are going out.
Yeah, yeah, and we should have some for sale soon. We'll let you know about that.
Yes, indeed. All right, yes. So if you are a Kickstarter backer, be on the lookout for some sort of notification for your shirts if you haven't yet already.
Yes.
And if you get one, take a picture of yourself in it and tweet at us, and you can show the world how stylish you look.
Absolutely. Yeah, we love, I always love seeing people post pictures of their stuff, and we do see that, and we do appreciate it, so thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's one more thing with this Kickstarter that we're trying to knock out, and, hopefully the rest of the stuff will come in due time. But, yes, of course, thanks again, everybody. While you're at it, if you can, go ahead and play some Namco Museum while you listen to this. I recommend Grobda. I believe that's on volume 2.
Sounds like a Russian soup.
Isn't Grobda the one about the tank from Zevius?
Yep. Yep.
It's all part of the same universe.
Yep.
Grand Namco Unifying Theory.
Some of those tanks married and something came out of that. I don't even want to know.
Oh, I wish. All right. Thanks once again, everybody. Goodbye.